Thanks, guys. Okay. Hi, everyone. I'm Alex. I've been on the OData team for, a couple of years now. And actions and functions, I suppose that's kind of like one of my babies. I love this feature. So you're going to get it from the kind of the horse's mouth, so to speak. So let me frame this a little bit. So the way I'm going to approach today's session is I'm going to give you a little introduction to actions and functions, and then I'm going to, well, I'd start with actions, and then I'll dive into some code to sort of show you the impact that that has on a typical server. If you have actions and you have a system which has got behaviors and things associated with it, and then I'll talk about functions and what that effect, what sort of effect that has on your model as well. We don't have any working bits that have functions supported on the server side. We documented it in the protocol. People like SAP and so forth have those features, so we'll leave it to those guys to show us some of that stuff. Maybe they'll be able to talk about it later. I don't know. So if you're familiar with OData, you'll be familiar with something called service operations. Service operations was kind of like the back door. You could get out from the uniform interface, and you could have functions that returned some data, and you could use that to do little things a little bit outside of the norm. But so this slide, I'm going to contrast service operations, functions, and actions. So we talk about it in terms of side effects, how composable they are, what sort of parameter types they can take, the parameter locations, where you put the parameters, do they belong in the body, in the query string, and so on, and how hypermedia friendly the feature is. And I'm going to throw service operations under the bus a little bit, because I'm using color coding to kind of indicate how happy I am about a particular thing. And red means I'm not very happy. So if we start with service operations, the first thing here is how, you know, do they have side effects? So the problem is they may or they may not. And what verb do you use when you invoke a service operation? It could be post, it could be get. So there's nothing in the protocol that stops you from having a side effect in get, which I think is pretty bad with service operations, hence the red. So that's kind of the service ops state of the world. And whether they're composable, again, we didn't have a way to indicate whether they were composable. You could try. You could try doing things after you call a service operation. So a service operation, you could have a URL that identifies a service operation, and then potentially you could apply filters and navigations after that. But, you know, the server might not support that. And you couldn't know for sure. And then service operations are essentially, you know, they're operations that potentially take some parameters. And the only types of parameters that service operations supported were primitive. So that's kind of limited. If you want to pass more information around, maybe you needed to pass a collection of something to the server. And the parameter location, all your parameters had to go into the query. So into the query part of the URL. So even if you were doing a post request and, you know, invoking a service operation through a post, you had to pack all your parameters into the query anyway, which, again, I don't think that's great. And then from a hypermedia perspective, they were never we never told you that you could do them other than by going to $ metadata. So if you retrieved an entity, it didn't, you know, there was no indication there that there was a service operation available. Okay? So let's look at functions now. So functions then have no side effects. I think that's the official definition of a function. And so I'm drawing this green. And of course, because they have no side effects, it's pretty safe to invoke them with a get. They are composable, or at least you can indicate whether they are composable. So the way we define them in metadata, a server might opt out and say, no, I don't want you to compose on this, but at least you know. We support all sorts of parameters to functions. We support primitives, complex, collections of primitives, complex, and also entities. There's a star next to that because that's limited to just the first parameter. Because the first parameter to a function you can use as a binding parameter. So you can essentially attach a function to a URL that represents a collection of entities or a single entity. And that's kind of why there's just a little star there. It's a very useful feature, but it doesn't fully scale across all the parameters yet. Where can you put the parameters? Well, it's a get. So you kind of, there's only two places you could put it. You could put it in the path, or you could put it in the query. I think this is better than just being limited to the query, because now you can co-locate the parameters with the function call. If you put the, if the function call is in the path, so you can put some of the, you can put the parameters in the path as well. And this is probably, you know, one of the bigger ones. If I go and retrieve an entity, the server can advertise back whether that entity has any functions available on it, or available that are bound to it. So that's hypermedia. Actions. So this is slightly different now. These things have side effects, and as a result, you have to post to them. We're thinking about maybe in the future allowing you to kind of define actions that do other things like put, delete, and so forth. But you know, we haven't got that far yet in this version of the protocol. They're not composable. They could have been composable, but it kind of made sense to kind of limit them at one action at least at this point. We could have done something where we took the body of a request and made it like a multi-part thing with a multi-part form where each part of the form represented parameters to different actions in the query. But that seemed like it was maybe a vnext kind of thing. Again, we support all parameter types. And even though there's a star next to entities, I think that that's the primary use case, right? So you have an action that's bound to an entity, or a collection of entities, and the role of that is to somehow mutate that, either that entity or that collection, typically. So an example might be you might have an action that's bound to a collection of entities, which creates a new entry in that collection. And then there's some interesting things about that, because if you were doing that through the uniform interface, if you were posting to that collection, you would be limited to providing the data that the entity has defined, right? But maybe you need to provide some more information, or maybe you want to provide less. So things that are not on the entity, because let's say you need to provide some credentials or something like that in order to invoke the entity. They don't actually invoke that action. They don't actually belong in the entity that you're going to create, but they're needed to start that process off. So that's really useful. Well, you've got a post, so let's put the parameters in the post, which means that now you have less size limitations, right? You can now, if you have a parameter which is a collection of complex types, you can get pretty big. And again, as I said, with functions, these guys can be advertised in the results of an entity. So if you make a request that returns an entity, you can advertise in that entity, here's an action you can call that will somehow mutate this entity or have some other side effect on the system. Okay, so what do they look like? So this is an action. And the reason I can tell that this is an action is because it says is side effecting equals true right at the top there. So it shows up as a function import, which is the same as the way we did with the way we modeled service operations as well. So if you're familiar with those, it's essentially the same concept. The difference is service operations had this mhttp method attribute, which was how you could tell whether it was a post or a get. With this, we you're not allowed that. That's kind of legacy now. That's service operations. And I think it's fair to say that we think of service operations as legacy. So this, because I can see that it's side effecting and it's bindable, that means it will bind to URLs of this that represent resources of this type, the first type here. So any URL that represents a customer, I can potentially invoke this action against. Although it says M is always bindable equals false, that means, maybe not. Okay, so this is where kind of hypermedia comes in. Like, you can't always know that you're going to be able to invoke this action. You should rely on the server to tell you you can. So, and we need to leverage these kind of things as we design other parts of the protocol. Like, for example, the efficient format. If we're defining an efficient format where we don't want to send everything to the client that they can deduce from metadata, well, from an instance perspective, if I can't tell that this is always available, then this is not one of the things that I can leave out. I have to add it when I send a result. Otherwise, the client will have no idea. So what do I mean by, you know, actually putting it into the entity? Because I've talked about it a lot of times, and you may be all going, well, what's he talking about? This is what I mean. I've made a request to go and get a particular customer, and right down here, this is JSON format, the V2 format of JSON, or what we're now calling the verbose format. And you can see here, here's an action, and this is kind of the identifier for the action. This is like a human-readable description. You might want to put that on a button or something like that. And then here's where you need to post to invoke that action. Okay, now, the interesting piece is, at this point, I would need to go to the dollar metadata to figure out if this has any extra parameters. But this tells me where to go. This is the name, this is the entity container name, this is the action name, and so from that I could go look at the thing we had on the previous slide and go, oh, okay, so I've got to provide some extra parameters when I do a post to invoke that. So let's skip into a demo, and this is going to be pretty exploratory. I've got a code sample that I put together which creates which is an action provider for the entity framework. Okay, now it's sample code. We didn't actually ship this as part of WCF Data Services, or we're not shipping this, but we shipped all the interfaces to allow you to do this. Now, if any of you are familiar with implementing custom providers with WCF Data Services, you'll know that it's not easy. So we tried to make sure that this would, the amount of work you'd have to do this, if you were leveraging other provider code, like our built-in entity framework provider and our built-in reflection provider, was kind of minimal. So we did as much as we could to make sure that you could kind of rely on the existing implementations. You didn't have to build everything from scratch. Anyway, so what I've got here, let's have a look at this. I've got an entity framework code first, if you're familiar with code first, model that has a number of sets in it. And you can see here, this is the classic movie sort of scenario. So I've got actors, directors, genres, movies, and so forth. So you notice there what have I got? I've got eight sets. Okay? But it's interesting that I don't want to actually expose a lot of this stuff onto the web. I want people to be able to manipulate, for example, user ratings through the web, but I don't want people to be able to query them. Maybe I'm going to aggregate that into something. Or maybe I want people to be able to, I don't want people to be able to modify rentals, but I do want people to be able to check out a movie. Okay, so what we're going to do in the rest of the demo is, well, in this code, when we walk through it, is it's going to actually kind of expose just the bits to the web that we want people to manipulate directly. And then anything else, we're going to manipulate through actions. So those are my sets. So if I look at my model here, you can see in here what I've done is I've said, hey, everything is read. You can read every set apart from these guys. So this EDM metadata's, that's from code first. So I think a general best practice is you hide that thing. And then here I've hidden users. I don't want people to know who the users are. I don't want people to be able to query the users in my database. I don't want people to be able to see the rentals, and I don't want people to be able to see the ratings. But what I've gone and done is I've implemented an action provider that works with the entity framework, and the way that this thing works is it actually goes and looks in my model class for actions. And you can see I've got these kind of regions. I usually hate regions, but for this particular demo, it's actually kind of useful. And they kind of fall into three categories. One is these occasionally bindable is what I'm calling them. You could call them anything you want. But what that really means is actions that are kind of hypermedia driven, right? Like when I get a particular entity, it's subjective about, it's kind of at the time you get that entity, you'll know whether you can invoke the action. And then I've got these always bindable ones. And then I've also got non-bindable. So non-bindable are kind of like service operations, except for they don't have the baggage of service operations. So they have the correct verb, they have all the support for all the different types of parameters, but you just call them at the root of the service. You can't attach them to resource paths that identify entities. So let's look at one of these. Here's a good one, checkout. And you can see what I've done here is I've said, hey, this is a, I've done it by using an attribute, but you know, you could do this however you want. This is saying, hey, there's an action here. It's called checkout. It binds to a movie. And what it does is it goes and, if we walk through this code, it goes, looks for the current user, looks to see if they've already got any rental for that movie. If they haven't already got the thing checked out, it will go and create a new user rental for them. But of course, that user rental isn't exposed to the data through the data service or through the OData service. So I can't hit user rentals. But using this action, I can modify the underlying data. So it's using the user rentals as a way to control what is available through the OData service. And essentially, this is where the hypermedia part comes in. So now I've hidden behind my service and behind the actions a set of implementations which are kind of like, I don't want the web to know about. So let's see this thing running. It's already running, which is useful. If I hit $metadata, you can see here I've got my normal entities, got all the entities that I need, which are those five there. I've got my associations. We don't need to worry about those guys. When we talk about the good, bad, and the ugly, I hope someone mentions them. And then we've got entity container. So the entity container is the thing which defines this, sort of the shape of the model. That's the entry point. And here I've got the five sets we exposed. And then I've got my actions. So I've got a checkout action, a check-in action. It says here that these things are bindable. And it doesn't say that they are always bindable or not always bindable. And the default is that they're not always bindable. So if it doesn't say something, it means that they're not always bindable. Whereas this action down here, this rate action, that's always available. Okay? So let's go and get a particular, let's go and get a single entity now. And you can see that this is avatar. And I can check that out if I want to. And the way I could check that out is by posting to this URL. So let's do that. See if I've got a breakpoint set up. Because I know you guys want to see the code, right? I hope you do. And you can see here I'm making a post request. I've said the application, the type of the body is application/JSON. And in this case, I've got just an empty object. This is a side effect of the version of the bits that I'm using. You don't need to actually send an empty object if there are no parameters in the protocol. It doesn't say you need to do that. But I happen to have code that requires this. So just ignore that part. So I execute that, and you can see now I'm just running my empirical logic, right? Like I've got my code in here, I've got the movie. I'm gonna just run through it, and I've now checked the movie out, hopefully. And the way we could probably tell is if I go and get this movie again, instead of saying checkout, it should say check in. And lo and behold, it does. That's because I've got it out. Now I can check it back in again. So this is hypermedia at its best, I think, although, you know, maybe the demo is a little bit simplistic, but you get the idea. So that's one example. Let me show you another one now, where what I'm going to do, is I'm going to go ahead and rate the movie. Okay, now, before I can do that, I need to kind of know what I need to do to rate it. So I need to know the parameters of rating for rating a movie. So I'll look at the metadata again. And if I scroll down here till I find this rate thing, you can see it's got two parameters. The first one is the binding parameter. That's the URL plus rate. And then, of course, I need to provide another parameter. It's called rating, and it's an integer. So I also happen to know, and this is where vocabularies would come in, that it needs to be a number between 0 and 5. So I'm going to choose one of those numbers. So here, if I say rate, and put into this body, rating 5. Have I got a breakpoint for this one? It's one of these always bindable functions. But I want to show you the logic here, because I think it's interesting in that it illustrates the kind of problem that people often have when they are implementing kind of update logic over a data service. You know, you've got these people doing uniform requests, so they just update something or patch it. And you've got to kind of infer what that means. Like, so for example, let's say someone tries to update a product, and they do what they're really, the only thing you notice that's different is that they've changed the price. Do they have the right to change the price? Maybe not, but they might have the right to discount something. Okay, and this is where actions are really useful. They allow you to kind of separate, an operation which you can't infer the intent from. So you see an update request, and it just changes the price, right? Well, I don't know if you are allowed to change the price. Versus, okay, you can update an entity and try and change the price using the old approach. No, you're not allowed to do that. But if you go through an action and you call the discount action, I'll let that go through. Okay, so it kind of allows you to separate things. And another example here, in this particular example, I don't want people to go and rate a movie 20 times. I want people to rate it once. So the way I kind of confirm this is happening is I don't give them access to the user ratings set. They can't modify that whole set. They can't just keep posting entries into there. I will control access to that. They'll do it through this action, and I will make sure that there's only ever one rating per user, per movie. And that's what this logic does here. So it looks for a rating that already exists for this username for this movie. And if I find it, which I did in this case, I just update the rating that they have associated with it. So this means there'll only ever be at max one rating per user per movie. And it's much easier to implement this way. And, you know, if I look at my... Probably timed out, didn't it? I don't know. Is this it? Yeah, 204, no content. That just happened. I rated the movie, and everything's hunky-dory. Okay, so that's kind of my... quick deep dive into actions, what you can do with them. I want to know if there are any questions at the moment before I continue into functions. No one's got questions? Stunned silence? Any thoughts? I think this stuff is good. I'm excited. Come on, let's get excited. There must be some questions. Yes.
You mentioned, I'm just curious about the state of this in WCF Data Services mm-hmm. right now. So you mentioned the code didn't get in there, but as far as a reflection provider and any framework providers, mm-hmm. there's easy ways to.
Yeah, so the question was, it was more of a statement. The start of the statement was, I mentioned at the start of this that WCF Data Services didn't get a chance to fully implement the actions code, right? Like we didn't create built-in providers for the entity framework and for reflection provider. What we did was we implemented the interfaces that we created the interfaces that you need to implement. And we made sure as we were doing it, this kind of example that I've given you being the case in point, that you could implement that over the top of the entity framework or the reflection provider without having to re-implement any of the other stuff that our built-in providers give you for those stuff. So you don't have to re-implement iData service metadata provider for the entity framework to create an action provider. You don't have to re-implement iData service query provider. All you need to focus on is iData service action provider, and we do the rest. So Yeah, we didn't get to that. We really want to get to that. But the min, I think I actually think that I suspect that in the community, people will write these implementations that you can just plug into any act, any entity framework provider, any sort of any entity framework model. Now, I mean, my example is kind of like a case in point. You could use this pretty much anywhere. Any, yep.
Just a question, big picture question. Mm-hmm. It sounds to me, and this can correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds to me like you're describing kind of one scenario where the data service is really exposing the database, right? Read mm-hmm. capability, of the database. Mm-hmm. And you're going to run into situations where you don't want to expose the database directly, so you're kind of masking the database through functional access, right?
Yeah.
To the side. And at least that's the way, the scenario you gave.
Yep.
I'm sure there's other ways you could think of using this.
Yep.
That's a problem we've run into in spades. And it seems like there's two ways to attack that problem. Mm-hmm. If your objective is like Netflix to kind of expose read-only access to some public data, exposing it as a data service is pretty straightforward. But if you're actually trying to build a website mm-hmm. that has a lot more logic between the public API and the data layer,
yep.
you really run into this problem on almost every request.
Yep.
What's accessible in what states, to what people,
mm-hmm.
Does the model match publicly what's in the database?
Mm-hmm.
So as you start to, as the product grows, it starts to deviate more and more because the database is less flexible, in terms of change than generally the public API for some reason.
Yep.
So it seems to me like what would happen down the road is you'd end up with a very functional public API and a much less restful. I mean, I think you'd agree this is not really a purely restful approach. It's kind of a way to get things done that you might need to get done, which is certainly, understandable. But, taking that approach, I would see our site becoming very quickly a pile of functions, right, and not
yeah.
actually a data API. So, the approach we took to that problem was to actually build an entity model for the public API and an entity model for the database. So it's
yeah.
not really about exposing the database anymore and to try to keep everything not functional, right? Reading and writing through the purely RESTful API.
Okay, so I think these are some very good points. I'm not going to repeat the question because it was really, really long. what I'm going to say, though, is that I agree completely. There is a distinction between the entity model or the data model and the service model. And it just so happens that our tools don't make it easy to kind of tease that apart today, right? But I suspect that people in this room who are implementers of custom data services are doing that automatically. I know that when we talk to SharePoint and various other teams, they are definitely doing this stuff. So there is a distinct difference between the data model and the service model already. So that's one part of it. The next part is, is this REST versus functions? Or is it a data API versus functions? I think there's a bit of a difference between a data API and REST, right? Like, this is RESTful in the sense that you are told what you can do. It's hypermedia driven, and so that's one of the tenets of REST. The fact that you're backing it with functions, well, all RESTful systems, at the end, they back to some kind of empirical logic, so I don't think there's a problem there. So It's a tricky one, that kind of distinction between REST and data APIs. And I think, we can have a discussion on that in the next couple of days to kind of drill in more. I do want to drop in, though, quickly to functions before we run out of time. Because we didn't get time to put functions into WCF data services, but we spent the time putting them into the protocol. Okay, and I know of a number of people that are actually implementing functions in their data in their OData services. And so functions, though, are kind of like one of our key extension points. And so actions provide a kind of an extension point which allows you to mutate the system in ways that CRUD would not allow, right? Create, read, update, that kind of stuff. They wouldn't allow you to do that. But functions allow you to kind of modify the way in which you access the information, the way in which you get to data. So a good example would be, I want to navigate from a collection. Today with OData, this is not possible. So I can't go to a collection of something and then immediately navigate to something else. So I can't, in this example, get all the orders for all the customers. That's if you think about it from a link perspective, that's like a select many query. But I can do this. I can create a function called all orders that does that. And from the system's perspective, you know, I could advertise that action. I could advertise that function on the customer's entity set, so you know it's available. It's in metadata, so it's got all the kind of characteristics of being kind of a fully fledged member of the system. Not only that, it can be mounted anywhere I have a collection of customers. So in this case, I've gone and said, well, you know, staff member 6 has some customers. Give me all their orders. Okay. So the key thing here with functions is they can be mounted anywhere that the type system implies they could be mounted. So it's almost like a navigation property, but with a different set of constraints. I can do filtering and navigating. So here's another example of something I can't do without functions. So here I could probably rewrite it a different way, but I can't kind of write it like this. I can't say, hey, I want the most recent order for customer 6, and then I want the lines for that order. Okay, because I have to get into the query string, and once I'm in the query string, I can't navigate. I can do it like this pretty easily here. So here I create a function called most recent order that can be applied to any customer and will return an order. And now I have an order, I can navigate as I previously could. So I can go, okay, I've got an order. What does orders have? It has lines, so I can navigate to that. Those functions that I put into this path here, they can have parameters as well. So like, I want all the customers in a particular city, and then I'm going to compose that with this all orders thing, because that's a collection. So that's going to get a collection of customers, and then I'm going to get all the orders for all those customers, and then I want the most recent one. And now, key point, of course, the way I said it sounds really inefficient. It sounds like, oh, go get all these, and then, then do this, and then filter that, and then I just want the most recent one at the end, which sounds like a lot of work. Of course, this can all be tunneled to a database if you have the appropriate backend, right? So I can extend filter and order as well, an order by. So here I can actually put my functions in the filter. So is zip in city is a function that I've created here. And you can see it's taking as a parameter the zip code for one of the customers, from its address. And then it's saying, are they in Redmond? And then I'm doing, let's go and get the profit ratio for that customer as well, right? Like, I'm interested in whether that's important. And $it, that's what we call that's a way to refer to the outer variable, the variable that's currently in scope. Like in this case, it's the customer. If you need to pass that to something. So in terms of parameters supported, I don't know if these colors show up well at the back of the room. I hope they do. We support, as I said, we mentioned about this earlier. We support primitive, complex, collections, entity, and so on. Let's have a look at examples of each. So this is an entity. This is a primitive parameter. Pretty simple. Here I've got a collection of entities. And this syntax here is interesting. The reason why we separate the collection the complex type parameter itself from inside the path is because some of those characters are not very safe in a URL path. So we have an aliasing scheme. So you can just introduce an alias and put it in here, which of course gives you the ability to potentially reuse parameters as well, which is, you know, to multiple functions or in your filter, which is really useful when you are dealing with, for example, geospatial types, which are quite big. Okay. Here's another example. This time I've got a collection. So I want all the movies that are tagged with both quirky and Western. Okay. So parameter location. So we support inline. This is an inline parameter. It's just inside here. And that's just for primitives, though. We also support using aliases, and that's used. You can use that for anything, but generally, the reason you would use it is for collections and complex types, and collections of complex types. And we support using parameter names, which is for the last part in the path, last function in the path. And so let me give you an example of that. So this is one way of expressing a particular, expressing that query above. This is another way. Exactly the same query, just written a different way. And the reason why we support this syntax is because it allows people to send URLs from the server to the client that say, hey, here's the place you need to go to invoke a function. But you don't want, if I sent you this, you'd be in the business of parsing this URL. You don't really want to be in that business. But because we send you, we could send you this, if you know about this function, you know you just need to append tags equals to the query string, and you're done. And so that's pretty, we think that's pretty important for the hypermedia case. That's my talk on actions and functions. If you've got any more questions about it, please feel free to come and talk to me. I've got lots of extra stuff I can tell you for sure. Any questions? Oh, again, stunned silence? Okay. Thank you.
In observing the APIs that people put out, customers parent 6 parent close is less intuitive than customer /6.
Mm-hmm.
What are our thoughts on such syntactical sugar?
So one of the things that we're looking at as part of the, sorry, the question was, sometimes some of the choices we made in terms of how you provide parameters to functions and also keys is, some people like it, some people don't. What if you don't like it? We're going to have a lot of talks about how to address that with the efficient format. The efficient format has a kind of companion piece that goes with it, which is about templating URLs and how the server can tell you how it enforces what URI conventions it uses. So I highly recommend you go and listen to that session, the one about the new JSON format.
And okay? Isn't it true that the URL should be entirely opaque, at least by this point, and you can choose whatever URL format you want?
Yeah. Sorry, what was that?
I don't know if we're completely there yet, but at this point, shouldn't URLs be largely opaque and you can choose whatever URL format you want?
So the question is, shouldn't URLs essentially be opaque? I mean, I think
it's
that...
convention.
Well, so there is this tension between, do you want the URL to be completely opaque so no one can... So everybody has to be told everything they can do. And one of the advantages...
Yes.
That's essentially what REST is, right? Yeah. Like, well, we'll tell you everything you need to do. One of the advantages of OData over a purely RESTful system is we actually have metadata as well, which means that you can, I can independently come up with a query. I don't need to go and I don't need to go and get some resources to be told what I can do with it. And like, of course, if I get told what I can do with it, aren't I back in the SOAP world again? Like, essentially, aren't I kind of back in this world where they can only tell me so much, otherwise it's going to get verbose again? Like, they could tell me everything I could possibly do, but what are they going to do? Tell me every combination of parameters I can call? Tell me every function I can call? And I think that's one of the advantages of what we got. We have a system which allows for conventions, but some people don't like those conventions. So how would we allow people to take some different conventions?
I mean, all I was asking is whether it was actually convention or it actually still, because I know in some places in the earlier versions it was, like in the data services client, it's actually building up URIs, assuming parentheses, et cetera, which is not convention. It's actually embedded in the implementation. But I think we're kind of at the point where it's convention. So if you didn't like it, you could choose a different format.
So we're not strict. So one of the things that we've done is we've spent some time trying to make sure that our client is as payload driven as possible, or as depends on what the service conventions as much as possible, so that we don't guess what the server does. And we're trying to take that as far as actually even the link provider. So the link provider, like when you do a filter by a particular property, or when you navigate from one set to another set, we want that to actually kind of look at the metadata and say, well, how do I do that? And at the moment, we don't do that. It's all by convention. So when the link generator is processing those URLs, it just concatenates what it expects the URL to be, the new URL to be. But we want to go further than that.